Hello again, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Congress Two Beers In. My name is Matt Glassman. I'm a senior fellow at the Government Affairs Institute, and I'm here today with my colleague, Josh Shooter. How you doing, Josh?
I'm good. How are you doing, guys?
And our special guest today is Philip Wallach, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and has just written and just published a wonderful new book on Congress called, quite simply, Why Congress. Welcome aboard, Phil. We're so happy to have you here.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
So I guess we should start at the obvious spot, which is, why do you have to write a book called Why Congress? What spurred you to write a book of this title, and what is the overarching argument of your book?
Okay, so I'm not really a Congress lifer. I have tremendous respect for people who devote themselves to the institution, either on the inside or as scholars. I think of myself as sort of a big picture separation of powers guy, and somebody who thinks about the American policymaking system more broadly. And I've really come to focus on Congress in the last several years of my research, because it seems like Congress is in some ways sort of the weak link in the American separation of power system today. It's sort of the wobbly leg of the stool. And so we have a sense that to make the whole system function better really requires re-energizing Congress, getting it to take itself more seriously, getting everyone else to take it more seriously. And the central argument of the book really is that Congress has to be the place where we work out our hardest problems, because it's the place where we sort of get all these representative elements in contact with each other and mix it up. And you really don't have a substitute when you try to just work things through the other branches. We do an awful lot of policymaking today by trying to work around Congress. And my basic argument is that that leaves us with some very big legitimacy problems, and often with bad policy. And there's really just no substitute for Congress. That's the argument of the book. So as much as I share a lot of the worries about our contemporary Congress, I feel like an awful lot of folks are just kind of inclined to give up on the place. And my book is sort of an apologia saying why we can't do that, why we have to fight for it.
Well, I had a question for you, Philip. I mean, I love the book. As a Congress lifer myself, I had a deep appreciation for a lot of the core arguments that you were making. And one of the things that I wanted to get your opinion on, and I mean, you flesh this out throughout the book, but I mean, I think one of the central problems that people have with Congress as an institution is that it doesn't think about our problems correctly, right? It doesn't have the right incentive structure to think long-term, to plan long-term, to address issues in a timely manner when they should be addressed. And that's something that the executive branch does like a little bit better. But I think people see it as that you see Congress as an institution that really lacks much foresight. So what sort of ways in which do you feel Congress, what sort of gaps is it filling as you look at it in terms of our representational system? Because it's not very good at looking far down the road. So what do you see as the value that Congress brings?
So I'm very taken by sort of an idealized picture of Congress that conservatives fleshed out during the New Deal era. Conservatives had a lot of affection for Congress at this time in American history, and they thought of it as kind of the earthy branch, the branch that was, by virtue of being close to the people, sort of better connected to the real, and as opposed to the sort of quixotic utopian schemes likely to come through the executive branch. And so in some ways, Josh, what you said about long-term thinking, yeah, I agree, the sort of the way that Congress's incentives work, that may not end up being its forte. But I think when Congress is working well, it sort of brings this closeness to the people to bear on our problems and says, what will the people actually accept? I think it's the branch most closely in touch with sort of what we really care about when push comes to shove, we the people of the United States. And we have to do politics, you know, with the people we have not the people we wish we had. And I think Congress at its best makes sure we do that. And, you know, I think there's a productive tension between Congress and the executive branch and the presidency. I don't by any means wish that the presidency would just become sort of a clerk that does whatever the Congress wanted. We're not in any danger of that, but I wouldn't wish for that to be the case. I think it's better for the president to be the big picture guy in many ways and helping shape the agenda with the kind of some of the big picture concerns that the president can bring to bear and the long-term concerns. But then having to deal with that sort of earthiness of Congress. I like that as sort of the ideal way for the system to work.
I took your book first and foremost as a almost a piece of political theory and Republican theory, that you were making an argument that a republic needs to function in a certain way, and trying to optimize policy outcomes isn't necessarily the correct mode for a republic even to be in, that the core stability of a republic is legitimacy of policy outcomes more than sort of optimization of them. And that the way you achieve that legitimacy is by having broad-based legislative consent that reflects popular will to those policies, even if the policies themselves are suboptimal to what sort of on paper an executive could do or a dictator could do or an authoritarian could do. That this was really a defense of sort of Republican theory, and that people may never be happy with that in the short term or in the instant or any policy, but that our goal here isn't to optimize policy. It's to make policy broadly acceptable and legitimize.
It's to create a sense of ownership, right? I mean, self-government, I have a paper that I wrote a number of years back called Self-Government in an Age, Self-Government in a Republic of 325 Million People. And I'm grappling with sort of the difficulties of figuring out what self-government can mean in a country as big as ours. And I think there's an awful lot of smoke blown, and we can come up with some really pie in the sky ideas that just aren't going to have any relationship to the realities on the ground. But my argument in that paper and in this book is that self-government is kind of a regulating ideal. We want to sort of lean toward doing things in a way that makes the American people feel like it's their government. If their government is screwing up, it's because it's theirs. It's not a bunch of alien oppressors, you know, in the distant capital working their nefarious will. It's them. It's we the people are the ones making these policies, and we have to have a sense of collective ownership, collective responsibility for what comes out of this process. I think, yeah, my argument is that creating that sense is really truly invaluable to us as a country, to our ability to hang together in through difficult times. And it's much more important than any particular optimal policy choice, right?
So, go ahead, Josh.
Well, one of the things that I would like you to talk a little bit more about is you kind of frame a lot of the book between sort of the Madisonian view of the Congress and the legislature versus the Wilsonian view of after Woodrow Wilson and a sort of efficient bureaucratic style of whatnot. I have a soft spot in my heart for anything that's anti-Wilsonian, just because I read his book, Congressional Government, was like, man, he really just hates politics. He just like can't stand like what Congress does when it goes to like represent people. So can you kind of flesh out like what you see is like the main foil of your book? Like what is Wilsonian? And because it seems to be like, it's a very profound sort of like thought throughout the American discourse in both sides of the aisle, that like Congress is an institution that cranks out policy, and it's almost like never quite been exactly that. It's never at least it's a weird frame to look through it, especially when you consider the way that like Madison was thinking about it.
So let me just lay out what I take the main sort of idea of that Madisonian and Wilsonian views to be, and then say a little bit more about why I favor the former. So Madison's idea, which is familiar to anybody who's got, you know, been exposed to Federalist number 10, is that you have a whole lot of factions. You know, they're created by differences of all of any number of kinds, class differences, regional differences, religious differences, and by virtue of having many, many factions and mixing them together, you ensure that no faction tyrannizes. And you kind of, by forcing them, by all these having these factions all come together and do the work of legislating, you have figured out a sort of workable modus operandi for government, a way that your people can live together and get along. And that's the value. The process is the value in large part, as much as any of the products of the process. The process means that we are doing the work of self-government. The Wilsonian view says, man, that's all very messy and comes up with bad results an awful lot of the time. I think there's a lot of worry about just sort of corruption as well. It's sort of, oh, well, it's all well and good to say that the factions come to some meaningful pursuit of the common good, but what they're really doing is just all paying each other off, and sort of the general public is the loser. And, you know, that can be more or less powerful critique depending on the moment. I do think when Wilson wrote his congressional government around 1880, it was a very powerful.
I was about to say, like, yeah, at the time, corruption was like a real big deal in Congress.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think, you know, the Wilsonian solution to that is let's clean everything up. Let's simplify everything. And that'll make responsibility very clear. And the American people will decide things at elections, and then we'll do our best to sort of allow the winning party to implement its agenda and do so efficiently through, you know, modernized administration is a big part of that vision. And you're right. It's very much an idea of sort of submerging politics. So it's not so much messing everything up. You sort of make politics happen within the parties and then go to the people, and then you get a mandate. I think that's very important, is like this idea of a mandate is, I think, sort of one of the key hallmarks of the Wilsonian way of thinking, which has become, I argue, very, very dominant in our political culture today. So the idea is you win the election and you get to do your thing. And to the extent that the system doesn't work like that, it must be very disappointing. My book is trying to argue that, like, a legislature operating like a legislature doesn't need to be mandate driven as much. We're not shifting every single factional interest at every election. We still have sort of the same balance of interest, and they need to keep making deals with each other, whoever wins the election. And so it's not that elections shouldn't have any consequences. That would be an obnoxious position to defend. But we have sort of a government that thrives on relationships between legislators and a continuous lawmaking enterprise that depends on generating goodwill by figuring out ways we can work together, even though we don't agree with each other on some of the most important things. That's the sort of central concept of the Madisonian view. And part of what I'm arguing in the book is that we really need some legislators to rediscover that principle, because an awful lot of them speak in this mandate language today as if that's the only thing that matters. And to my mind, that really just sort of sells Congress short as an institution. It runs away from the institutional strength of a place that actually keeps everyone in an ongoing dialogue together.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people will take the title of your book quite naturally, Why Congress, and think of Congress as a noun in that title, the institution, the place up on Capitol Hill downtown. But I think reading the book, it almost makes as much sense to think of the word Congress in your title as a verb. That the idea here is that there's something going on when people get together that is much more profitable for self-government than just electing sort of actors to govern over people. And I think that's certainly important.
For the record, like, I'm a huge opponent of remote deliberation and remote voting. I think we've already you know, hollowed out a lot of these relationships by making it so members don't see each other enough. But actually, yeah, bringing the people together, having a Congress, a meeting of people, I think is very central to trying to have this sense that the government belongs to the people, belongs to our trusted representatives, and isn't just that Congress isn't just a rubber stamp, which is one of the things I grapple with toward the end of my book. Sort of one of the unfortunate possible futures for Congress is just becoming a place where, yeah, ministerially we vote yes on the deals that are worked out elsewhere, but it doesn't really matter that much what's actually going on Capitol Hill. And, you know, I think a lot of Americans feel like, oh, the swamp, I don't understand what's going on there. I distrust what's going on there. Therefore, the less of that that happens, the better. But to me, that's just totally the wrong way to think of how we can get people to feel like government answers to them. I think the more you make it just an accounting mechanism, the less you have a sense of ownership.
Because I think people sort of intuitively get this in other ways. Like I was looking at rules of order, and I came across an interesting section of it totally randomly where it was talking about whether you could have a sort of meeting, if you're following Robert's Rules of Order, whether you could have a meeting by email, right? Is that possible to have an electronic Robert's Rules of Order meeting? And the answer in their rule book is that you can't, but you could have a Zoom meeting. And because to them, the core function is that you're having sort of auditory exchanges that are free flowing and having sort of that sort of deliberative process.
Right.
And that sort of cuts the same way. I think when we say people, we often think about sort of like the individual representative relationship, like, you know, how can one representative represent 700,000 people? But that is sort of one connection. And the other connection is the connection between the representatives. And I think that's obviously what you're getting at. But I used to poo-poo that. I used to sort of dismiss that as important. But I think as I've spent more time in actual legislative dynamics, or people think as adults is what they spent time in, be it at a PTA meeting, right, or at a homeowners association meeting, there really is something crucial, specifically on this legitimating issue, right, and legitimizing decisions, about having people talk something out and work something out in that format. It really does make a huge difference, rather than having sort of a debate over email or having decisions sort of
And I have to say that, like, much as I enjoy talking to you guys over Zoom right now, it makes a big difference to me that I've sat with both of you in person before.
Yeah.
I feel like the kind of intercourse that you can have with a person in real life is actually like a lot better than on Zoom, because it's easier to interrupt each other. It's easier to like take someone's temperature on how they're feeling about what you're saying through their body language and all that. Like, I mean, Zoom is a lot better than a regular telephone call, you know, which is a lot better than an email exchange, I guess. But I do feel like, yeah, the actual face-to-face encounters really matter. And we ought to be giving our representatives more chances to do that, because I actually think that the folks that get elected tend to be kind of agreeable and good at getting along with other people. That's part of what helps them figure out how to get elected. Not every one of them. There are other paths, I guess, but a lot of them. And it's actually just a healthy thing for our system to get people talking to each other face to face, because they find ways of liking each other, and that makes them more likely to be able to work with each other in non-zero sum ways.
I think one of the things that I really appreciate about the book that I think articulates better than most books on Congress is really the kind of like the dual benefits of being in person and being in a place where people from different representational and constituent backgrounds like come together, like physically come together. And the first one is like the legitimating piece, where you have sort of a bunch of lawmakers who are literally a part of a process, right? They are able to air their grievances. They're able to make amendments. They're able to offer suggestions. And if their suggestions don't win, that, you know, they were part of the process and they just lost, right? That's part of it. That in itself, of just being a participant within a broader process, creates more legitimacy to the decision makings than if somebody just kind of like shows up, run roughshod, and you're like, well, the game was rigged from the start, right? Sort of thing. So that's the first part. But the second part, I think, is also really important, that you highlight throughout the book is that, you know, the process of coming together also creates the kind of strange bedfellow situation where you can find commonalities with different members on highly significant topics, right? For people across the aisle, right? You know, there are a bunch of issues that have regional divides that animate members a lot more than, say, just kind of your standard partisan issue. And without sort of like coming together and creating these opportunities and these spheres through which people kind of interact and participate, you don't have the opportunity to see like those other coalitions pop up. And I think it's something that I think a lot of people don't focus on that maybe should a little bit more, that it's more than just sort of like being in one place. Like it's really about like being a participant and then offering and creating relationships that enable different coalitions to emerge every once in a while.
Yeah. I one of the things I try to say over and over again is like a well-functioning legislature ought to be like a really interesting place. Because you sort of don't know what you're going to get from this mix of people and personalities and you know, sense of what's really important to their constituents. You mix it all up and you ought to get some interesting things coming out that weren't in anybody's party platform to start with, because you sort of find out what compromises are viable through the work of interacting with each other and of conciliating each other. And that should be exciting. And anytime we sort of have the sense that what our legislature has become is like a place for repeating sort of stale platform lines and sort of talking at cross purposes and then moving on with nothing coming out of it, you know, I think that we have a sense that that's a very boring place. And I think that's a sense that because the legislature is really not realizing its potential.
Yeah, that's one of the things that is a little frustrating now is like, you know, the interest is in sort of in the drama at the moment, right? So it's in like, ooh, they're supposed to work together, but they're not working together. And like now nothing's getting done. And it's less interesting in the sense that like, if you go back to debates in the 1930s, the 1940s, and you're talking about sort of like, you know, the soldier bonus bill was a fascinating piece of legislation because you have a situation where like legislators in the majority party are saying like, yeah, like I'm going to go ahead and just go around the committees and the party leadership and it's going to make them upset. But, you know, we have a majority for this coalition to pass a soldier bonus bill to give them basically their pension before they were due because everybody's in the Great Depression and needs money. But it was an interesting dynamic because here's an individual legislator who is, you know, sparking a process that's going to suddenly create, like force others to adapt to it. Right. And it was forcing a new coalition to sort of come up and force this issue on the floor. Whereas today, like, you know, conservatives sort of hijack the floor, but nothing's happening, right? It's not the same dynamic. They're not trying to create a new coalition at the moment. What they're doing is they're just trying to like stop stuff.
Right. Hijack the floor for their own purposes. I think the always keeping in focus, like a legislature is about coalition building. I mean, our modern Congress can do other things. It can be a place for generating publicity in important ways. Like I can't say that every single activity on Capitol Hill is about coalition building, but that is the core of the enterprise, or ought to be. And if you as a legislator are not involved in coalition building on behalf of the things that you think are important, then you are not doing your job. And I you know, unfortunately, like the way people get elected, some of them can succeed doing a different job, you know, and getting reelected. But if, you know, I it's just a little mystifying, and maybe we can turn to the current events now a little bit, but like an awful lot of these people seem to think that coalition criticizing is their job and they don't need to be a part of any coalition that has a chance of passing anything because everything is so corrupt or so terrible and they would rather just sit in judgment of it all. But if you're not building coalitions that you can be a part of that can carry your policies into effect, I just don't know what you're doing.
Well, it seems to me that what a lot of people are doing is they're trying to, they've subverted sort of, as you said before, that the primacy of governing, and however you want to define that, for the primacy of elections, right? And right. Instead of elections leading to governing opportunities, it's governing opportunities leading to electoral success, right? It's like it's a very sort of cart before the horse mechanism. And I see it all over Congress, right? I see it in members who don't see anything but the presidential election ahead of them. I see it in leaders who are right. scared to govern because they're worried about the collapse of sort of whatever fragile electoral coalition they have held together. Yeah. And it's a very sort of mentality that is not sort of productive for the institution in any sense, but it's not just sort of.
No, to be fair, it's not crazy at all. And like the more that we've already allowed Congress to become marginalized, or that we circumvent Congress in an awful lot of our policymaking today, it's just sort of factually accurate to think that who sits in the White House is by far the most important thing about what kind of policies we carry out in this country today. That it's just true. I can't deny it. But, you know, that said, again, it's sort of forfeiting the institution's own comparative advantage to make it an electioneering body, essentially, because it has this coalition building, you know, capacity is the Congress's superpower, I guess, if you want to put it like that. And if it's not willing to use it, then it's bound to just become kind of a second fiddle.
So in your book, you talk about, you have some vignettes or case studies of when Congress was working. And your case studies are mid-20th century, the Congress during World War II, and then Congress during the peak era of the civil rights movement in the mid-20th century. They're wonderful vignettes, but my question is, would we know it if Congress was working now? Like, how much observation would it take to know if Congress is working? Like, if I got blasted back to 1943 inside the head of someone from 1943, would I be able to recognize, just as a casual observer, a functioning Congress? Or is this something that takes a much more analytics? I'm not talking about whether Congress will be popular. Right. I don't think Congress was more popular in 1943 or 1964 than it is now, maybe a little bit. But how much does it take to actually recognize sort of Congress working? And can you even do it in the moment, do you think?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think there is something to the idea that, like, it's gonna be ugly when it works. So if we're hoping for it to ever be really beautiful, we're only just gonna be perpetually disappointed. And politics in general is always gonna frustrate people, right? You're always gonna feel like you're getting half a loaf at best. And so to the extent that you're very focused on good policy performance of some kind or another, I think you're always going to, even when Congress is working well, you're still going to feel kind of like it's not doing great. So I do try to appreciate that when thinking about our problems today. And I think I do sometimes wonder if I'm too hard on the place, because it does make certain things work still, right? I mean, it could be worse. And our country is like very, very divided, and they have a hard job, and they do get a lot of things done still. And so I try to acknowledge that in the book, even as I'm raising my concerns about where it is today. But I do think on this central question of, like, do we feel like it's an interesting place? Do we feel like coalitions are getting built on a regular basis to deal with important things? I guess that's where I feel disappointed about where the institution is today. And I think where you could have felt better in 1943 or in the 1960s, I think you just sort of had more action in the coalition building sense, and therefore a little bit less of a sense of futility. You might have had a sense that, like, we were making bad mistakes. I think, to me, making mistakes seems not as bad as sort of generating the sense of futility and the consequent sort of sense of alienation.
I think one of the things that interesting about it is even back then, and if you look at the, you know, newspaper coverage of Congress in like the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, I mean, a lot of it was negative, right? It was still like very much like sort of a place that doesn't function. It's not addressing problems. It's not doing this and that. And to the extent that the media was overall like net positive on Congress, which are the moments that you point out to, right? Like during World War II and the war effort that's going on, the types of powers they were delegating to the president. And then the 60s, you have like the New Deal, you've got the Civil Rights, you've got the Voting Rights Act. They were overwhelmingly positive in those moments. And it seems to be this sort of like, again, it's a sort of Wilsonian bias. Like the institution is good to the extent that it's making decisions, right? And I think one of the parts that gets overlooked is that to the extent that it's not making decisions or not making clear decisions, or they're making messy decisions or not great decisions, that's also Congress working, right? And I don't think that that's sort of been an inherent bias that like making decisions and passing policy is like a good Congress, whereas a Congress right. that sort of like fits and yells and screams and tussles and has a struggle with making a decision is somehow a bad Congress. And in many ways, like sometimes, you know, David Mayhew had like such a poignant point. It's like sometimes Congress just doesn't figure it out, right? It's like sometimes it just fits and fusses and yells and screams, and that's Congress doing its job. Like it can't solve every problem. And in the policymaking process of like getting to that decision is often very messy. So, even when Congress is working well, at least in my opinion, it doesn't seem like we respect the process, right? There are certain things where we don't like, but there's no question that the decision making today is fundamentally different than what it was back then. Like Joe Biden and Kevin McCarthy in a room hashing out a deal for the entire government to okay would have been like sort of like a what, right, in the 1940s and 1960s. We really have lost sort of like a dynamic institution that just debates these things on like in real time, in favor of an institution sort of puts off inevitable decisions so that leaders can negotiate at the last minute.
Yeah,
and that seems fundamentally
what you said about the squabbling and fighting, like reminds me of our friend James Wallner, right? Like conflict is great, conflict is good, but failing to have conflict is part of the problem, right? It's if we really had a sense that we were slugging things out, and then at the end of the day we didn't figure it out, okay. But my feeling is that actually an awful lot of the most interesting debates are just completely suppressed and kept off the agenda these days. Right. We don't get the benefit of the conflict. We sort of just, you know, nurse a lot of resentments and mutual suspicions of each other without ever seeing whether we could find some concrete things to agree on.
Yeah, your chapter on COVID policy in Congress, which is sort of a very, I think, centrally scathing sort of critique of Congress in modern action in your book, really brings that home. I do think there's a sense that Congress has sort of agreed to play in this Wilsonian sandbox of sort of like technocratic competence being the highest ideal of a legislature. And that almost invariably leads you towards just deferring decisions to executive technocrats, essentially.
Right. It goes along with politics being a dirty word, right? I mean,
right.
If Congress can't stand up for the political as a worthy way of making sense of the world, then it's sort of already at a fundamental handicap.
Yeah, and I mean your criticism of Congress in COVID policy, their inability to sort of grapple with the fundamental sort of values questions at the root of it, and instead just shoveling money towards sort of every possible other government that's out there. Makes a lot of sense on those lines to me.
That's great. That's good to hear. One of the reviewers of the book hated the COVID chapter and said, "What you could? This is like something Congress actually did right for a change, and you're trying to criticize them for it. You should just get rid of this whole chapter, and the book would be stronger." And luckily, my editors over at Oxford agreed with my feeling that that's not right. I think it goes to show that just how low the expectations are on this conflict front. Like, we just did not have it out in Congress about so many of these important things. Like we barely had any kind of serious debates on them at all. And what debates we did have tended to be, let's debate Fauci, right? Let's second guess the bureaucrats to whom everything is delegated and decide whether we think they're heroes or villains. But actually, you know, that kind of frame just is likely to keep us pointing fingers at each other and yelling at each other without accomplishing anything. Whereas if we would actually talk about the substance, I mean, the thing that killed me about our whole society during COVID is just like the lack of creativity, just this assumption that we can't figure anything out. We can't like take our constraints and figure out what's important to us and figuring just like a sense of paralysis set in instead. And to my mind, all sorts of things in our political system just made that feeling of paralysis worse, when really the kind of energy and fighting about it was exactly what we needed to feel like we weren't just knocked on our backs.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is like we're seeing a paralysis of a different kind now. I mean, we've got a majority who has the house, but they for 2 weeks now have not been able to put a bill on the floor. And we're going to try today, starting in about an hour or so. This podcast will probably already be out, but it's a situation where, you know, there's clearly a group within the majority who feels like they haven't had the opportunity to get their ideas out. And to be fair, like they kind of haven't, right? Like, I mean, we have not had a direct vote on 2022 spending levels. We will now because they've hijacked the floor, but we haven't had a debate on entitlement spending on the House floor. I mean, so where do you kind of see this breakdown in the majority coalition in frames of what you've just been discussing?
Yeah. So when we go back to the January speakership fight and some of the things that the Chip Roy block of votes was saying that they wanted, it sounded great to me. It sounded very like it resonated with a lot of the themes in my book. They wanted to blow the house open. They wanted to more of a chance to debate the things that mattered to them. They wanted more of a chance to offer amendments. Two thumbs up. That all sounds great. And to the extent that they secured rules changes to make any of that more possible, like more power to them. But then like, what are you going to do with these opportunities? And this is where, like, again, it has to be about coalition building, really. Like, it seems to me that a lot of what they want is actually just the chance to have the floor time to broadcast their message, because they think that somehow if they're given a chance to broadcast their message, that will change everything. And I don't know, maybe at the next election, the American people will finally come to their senses and elect 400 Republicans. And then we'll get our chance to set things right. But that's crazy. Like, that's not going to happen. You have to be willing to build coalitions out of the actual elements of the American public that might constitute a majority. And I, when I'm looking at a lot of the stuff that McCarthy's Republican antagonists, what they're doing right now, I don't quite understand what it is they think that Congress is going to do if they get their chance to have their say. I mean, maybe they think the House might pass some of their bills that they care about, that, or maybe just debate some of their bills and that would be good. But like, come on. Let's fix, like, is there no way that you can be legislators who build coalitions and actually, like, are there no purple district Democrats that you can think about how to join forces with to help address the problem on the southern border? Like, it's endlessly frustrating to me that nobody even thinks in this direction right now. And you know, I do think, to the extent anyone's thinking in this direction, it's because, like, hey, maybe Republicans just don't have a governing majority amongst themselves. And so maybe as a matter of necessity, like, if you want to do any governing, that means putting together big bipartisan coalitions. And like, if that's the case, then maybe Kevin McCarthy kind of becomes a force for deal making in the House, which is an intriguing possibility to me. I would much prefer to see sort of a more bottom up, cross-factional kind of bargaining being the source of deals. And I'd love for the Freedom Caucus people to think of themselves as potential players in that kind of process. But if you're just a no vote on everything at the end of the day, on anything that could get passed through the Senate, then you're going to be marginal players. And there's just not much way around that.
One of the things that I think is interesting about this is I have a hard time understanding what their angle actually is, right? Are they really interested in some of these like procedural changes, or are they just trying to put their priorities ahead of everybody else's? And, you know, to the extent that we haven't seen many changes, right? One, either because Kevin McCarthy hasn't wanted to, or because they haven't held his feet to the fire. But the way the House has operated has not been different in any way, right? It's really,
we had one open rule at the end.
One open rule, right? Exactly right. Right. Mission accomplished. And we're moving on. It's just sort of a joke. And the thing that they're asking for right now, which is sort of like cutting spending back even further from the deals that were negotiated between Biden and McCarthy, it's a little nonsensical. I mean, it's not a bill that's going to pass. Otherwise, they would have gotten the votes already, right? And I mean, this would have been an easier deal to strike or bargain to strike if that was a feasible thing. And the most natural response to that, you would think, is like when you put these bills that are at lower numbers on the House floor, that people go on there and just plus it up and to get it back to where it was at the beginning. And so I don't know what the actual angle is. It seems like they kind of just want to extort the speaker to a degree and to in order for him to like force their issues on the floor. But they don't seem terribly interested in using the process to force their issues on the floor. They're more interested in kind of like extracting leverage over McCarthy to do that. And it's hard to gauge like how this ultimately ends. I mean, they'll, on the one hand, like conservatives will lose this battle if this is the one they choose to pick. And they can just continue to be no votes, but it does seem like there's some gettable things out there that they could get. And they're not attempting that, right? They're attempting some of these other gambits, if you will, that don't really change much about how the process works.
Do you think we should be empowering subpartisan caucuses like the Freedom Caucus or like the Progressives institutionally? This is a question that came up. I was talking to someone last week, and we were discussing how, you know, obviously the political parties have these massive institutional networks that run outside of Congress in all sorts of ways, but they're also, you know, a lot of institutional money is appropriated and spent to keep the parties in power on the Hill and underwritten with staff dedicated to party leadership things, and, you know, rooms next to the House floor that they have as party cloakrooms, and would fostering more sort of caucus type groups that were not part of the parties and institutionally supporting them, would that be better or worse? And I'm torn on that, but I was wondering what your perspective is from your view on sort of the institution right now. Like if the Freedom Caucus or any other group could more easily sign up to have staff and a meeting space and the ability to sort of institutionally support themselves, would that be a benefit or a hindrance right now?
I think I see it as a good thing. It would be, but I think there's just mainly like on the center right, there's a big gap that needs to get filled is one of the biggest problems. Just like the folks on the center right are not punching at their weight, essentially. And I think part of that is just an organizational problem. They're not well united together. Maybe there are factors that are sort of make it embarrassing to them to acknowledge that they are more or less a block. Like maybe they think that instantly opens them up to primary challengers, and so they don't want to do that. But like the Main Street partnership is not it. Like it's not an assertive enough body. It doesn't cause the members to think of themselves as a decisive voting block enough. And so I do feel like some of it is just if that group of folks on the center right could organize, then I think a lot of the bargaining dynamics could be healthier. I think the center left is better organized. Like I think the New Democrats and you know, the Blue Dogs are now going extinct more or less, but in the past those have been better organized factions, and I think often that's been constructive. So, you know, I think Gingrich killed, I forget exactly how the rules have evolved, but, you know, Gingrich killed off the legislative support organization as something that could get direct funding because he wanted to kill off the Democratic Study Group, which was a big, powerful organization that really did a lot to shape the policy agenda. And so from 95 onward, those groups were defunded, and they sort of have a more sort of pieced together ad hoc existence from that point onward. I think giving them more institutional grounding would be a good thing. Yeah.
One of the questions that I had for you, Philip, was, I mean, I constantly came back to this like strange bedfellows idea that you keep pointing to in the book, where these kind of like sort of unorthodox coalitions emerge to press issues onto the floor or press issues in front of Congress. This kind of requires like some unorthodox political alliances, right? Or issues within constituencies that are so powerful that encourage that member to break their partisan ranks, right? So we often see these sort of like strange bedfellows, mostly in moderate districts, right? Where they're sort of, here's an issue that's so important to me, that I have to break ranks with my partisan colleagues, right? So like immigration for like a Texas Democrat or a South Florida Republican, or maybe it's like manufacturing policy up in the North, in the Midwest or the Northeast or something along those lines, where you have this powerful constituent drive that kind of like forces partisans to reorient their ways. But with so much partisanship and such like safe constituencies, do you think that there's enough sort of like there are powerful enough issues to kind of break through that sort of like partisan impulse just to like back your party's position?
Yeah. So I think a lot of this goes back to the question that political scientists have liked to debate about to what extent polarization is a bottom-up phenomenon that just is in fact representative of the American people. I as somebody who feels like cross-pressured and sort of largely independent of the two parties, I've always really hated the idea that it's just is in fact that America has become this sort of simple bipolar place. I don't buy it. I guess I feel a little bit biased, so maybe my judgment should be taken with a grain of salt on this issue. But I think America is complicated and weird still today. I think the two parties are much less ideologically coherent than they like to pretend. I think there is still a lot of room for strange bedfellows to emerge from the organic strangeness of the country and what people actually care about. I think the more you talk about real things, the more you have those possibilities. The more you talk, the more you sort of allow things to float in the realm of partisan talking points. Well, yeah, the partisans are good at their jobs. We can get fully oppositional talking points on everything and stay on that level if we want to. But To me, like the possibilities of getting off that track are just so attractive. And I take the fact of rising independent registrations to mean something. Like I know an awful lot of people say, oh no, political independence, that's just something we should ignore. Like most of those people are just Republicans or Democrats one way or another at the end of the day. But I do think there's an awful lot of appetite amongst ordinary people who are less tuned into politics often, who just like wish that they got the sense from the political process that it was taking more seriously their concerns and making things happen in a constructive way rather than staying on the level of those talking points.
How much of we put a lot of blame on sort of the members themselves and sort of the partisanship and issue dynamics. How much at this point do you think can we correctly blame on sort of the modern presidency itself as an assertive actor? I go back and forth on this because I feel like watching Obama, Trump, and Biden on sort of their sort of willingness and no one resisting them from sort of jumping into the appropriations process in sort of major ways to be so disheartening. On the other hand, like, I do feel like people in Congress kick and scream in this, maybe not in sort of a unified institutional way, But what's really standing in the way is that the modern presidency has become politically powerful and savvy, and that Congress is in many cases trying to resist this stuff, but they just no longer have sort of the capacity to do it. And that once we unleash sort of the modern institutional presidency, it was almost bound to head this direction, regardless of whether Congress wanted to or not, because the sort of threshold for reining in this stuff is so high at this point, absent a legislative veto and with the partisanship. I just throw my hands up in the air that, you know, it doesn't seem like any of the partisans really want to reform the executive branch, except when it's a talking point out of power. Even though, like, you can see sort of majorities for a lot of this stuff a lot of the time, even sort of verbalized majorities.
Yeah. I mean, I think we do have to keep centrally in mind that, like, Donald Trump never sniffed 50% approval. Joe Biden mostly hasn't either. Like, it's not like these guys occupy the presidency and then sweep everything ahead of them in some way that sort of allows them to gain hold of the mass public in a really solid grip. Like, that's not happening either. I think, you know, there's a sense that, like, the expectations for the presidency are kind of crazy at this point.
But, like, I mean, it'd be one thing if sort of Trump, if you really felt like his administration had really gone to Congress and pushed a border war bill, right, and put a full court press on it, or that Biden had done the same thing on student loans, but they don't even try to do that, right?
Well, that's the thing. It seems like the expectations in some ways are becoming more rhetorical. I wrote a piece about this in National Affairs with a really good research assistant named Mikhail Good. And it's the piece is called The Emotive Presidency. And it's about, I mean, it's largely an attempt to make sense of Trump. But it's not just confined to Trump. There's this sense that what people want from the president is to broadcast their messages and feel the feels that they like to feel. Because that's so satisfying. I feel like there's just a lot of ways in which our policymaking process is becoming less about making policy, yeah, and more about doing certain kinds of performances. And I mean, that's a very unhealthy trend in general. And you know, there's all sorts of reasons that might be, like, politics filling a role in people's mental lives that it ought not fill. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I think Congress is very complicit in allowing the president to call the shots on a lot of things. And it's a collective action problem to reverse that trend. And so it's just not easy. But I don't see the presidency as really capable of bearing all the weight that's being put on it. And I think it turns to this fantasy stuff in large part as a way of just trying to at least please the partisans who are sort of the core supporters of the person. So it's not like a very happy set of it's not like we're finding a good way of making the system work that just happens to be kind of presidency heavy. I think the whole system is not doing that well.
Well, one thing that is striking to me about the presidents right now is that we talk about sort of the legitimating effect of a functional legislature, but there's also sort of the legitimate effect of just passing laws. And if you want a durable, like, sort of legitimate law that holds on for the test of time and you're the president, you would think your first idea would be like, let's pass this in Congress.
Yeah, I mean, look at student loans. I mean, if Joe Biden had made student loan relief a big priority and pushed for that in the 117th Congress, I'm pretty sure they could have found a bill that could have passed both chambers. And it would have not looked like the student loan relief that he passed through executive order, right? It would have looked a lot different. It would have been much less generous to well-off people. But you know what? Like, that would have accorded with the American people's sense of what was appropriate. Like, it would have been a better bill. It would have had no legal troubles. And if you actually cared about the policy, like, that's what you should have done. But I mean, that's the big question. Like, do they really care about the policy? Or in fact, was getting caught up in the Supreme Court like actually like an ideal outcome for them somehow, because it allows them to pose as the champion for certain groups and the other guy and make this, you know, the Roberts Court the bad guys? Like, if everything becomes about spinning narratives, yeah, it really does start to warp people's incentives pretty badly. Like, we really want to make things about the policies, because the incentives are so much healthier then.
One of the things that I think is such an X factor in all this is like the extent to which many of these of the groups in Congress are acting as like good faith negotiators, right? In other words, like, this is something that's really important. This is something we should do. And if it is, are you willing to move the ball like 5 yards down the road with a policy success, or sort of like yell and scream until you can move it in one like, you know, huge 20 yard chunk or something along those lines. And I think like a lot of people sort of take the iterative process of lawmaking less seriously, or less, I don't know, less desirable for some reason, right? They want the sort of like big moment. But I mean, to your point, I think if they could have done something on student loans, it probably wouldn't have satisfied progressives from the get go, right? Joe Biden's automatic student loan plan didn't get support from them for a variety of different reasons. It probably would have had to get some Republicans on board, in which case, like, you kind of lose it as an issue if you're a Democrat trying to push that policy. And at the end of the day, you have a bunch of leaders who are like sort of like don't want that coalition to pass that law anyway, right? They're sort of like, hey, if we're going to pass it, we want to pass it on our terms. And I think it's like it's those margins that are really hard to decipher at a far away level that matter a lot, and where party leaders have a lot of influence on whether a coalition passes something or doesn't pass something. But until they actually put it on the floor, like, we never know what that could look like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you've just described is an institution that's devoted, I guess, not just to electioneering, but electioneering and like some kind of interest group mollification, right? That we constantly have to be doing things to make our interest groups feel like we really understand the profundity of their concerns and that sort of thing. And it's not about policymaking. And again, yeah, I feel like that leaves us in a pretty sorry place. And I feel like a lot of people are sick of it. Like, I don't think I'm the only one. I think there are plenty of members who are sick of it. I think there is sort of a latent coalition to just say, like, let's do things differently. That said, when you do less iterative lawmaking, then putting, you know, less stock in iterative lawmaking makes sense. Like if it's not mostly happening, then investing my time in that model of lawmaking just seems less sensible. And so, you know, I do have sympathy for the members. Like, they're trapped in the institution that they're in now. They don't just get to wish it to be different. And that does make getting out of this sort of bad equilibrium a very difficult task.
Does killing the filibuster make things better or worse? I have this weird sort of dualism about it, because my instant reaction is that it probably just makes things worse, because it's sort of the ultimate Wilsonian reform, where suddenly then you just become this more tighter party-centric model slamming through the Senate. On the other hand, like, I don't think the filibuster itself is producing a whole lot of sort of like deliberative Senate right now.
Right.
And maybe getting rid of it would sort of make policy more live in Congress. And simply by making policy more live in Congress, we would return sort of some policy centrism in the institution. Just the same way as if we abolish the Senate, we might see more sort of live policy, since because so much more policy was possible, right?
Yeah, I share your ambivalence about this. I do think the way that the modern filibuster is practiced is sort of antithetical to the purpose of what it's supposed to be about. It's supposed to be, in my mind, the filibuster is this thing where because somebody cares so much about this issue, they're willing to grind the whole system to a halt. And you have to, and sort of to the extent of their physical ability to do so. And their concerns have to be taken seriously because of that. And that process, I feel like, could be very healthy. But that's not at all what it looks like today. Now it's just we need 60 votes. And a lot of times I think the 60 vote requirement has been kind of healthy. Like when you think about the successes in the 117th Congress, the 60 vote requirement had a lot to do with it, right? Okay, let's build some durable bipartisan coalition on infrastructure, on semiconductor stuff, on even on gun control. Like we got those bills through. The dynamics behind them were kind of healthier than most things have been in recent years. And the existence of the filibuster was pushing those things along. Now, you know, that said, it is hard to predict exactly how things would look if sort of the majority party didn't have the excuse of the filibuster, right? And actually just was sort of put on the spot to be responsible. Like how we would have thought about, you know, the Congress that was in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, for example, like we could have demanded more from them in some sense. Like if they weren't fixing things, it was more their fault. And I'm not without some sympathy for the Wilsonian points, like the cleanliness of responsibility has its appeal. But yeah, I guess in general, I'm doubtful and wish that we could make the place function in the more Madisonian way instead of giving up on that hope.
Let's talk about your sort of the last third of your book, as I see it, or maybe the last quarter of your book, where sort of provisions. Not too distant future either, right? You're talking about things happening sort of in the coming decades and three visions of where Congress should go. And one is sort of continued decay along sort of an ambling trajectory we have now. And another is Congress becoming something that looks more like a rubber stamp, almost like a parliamentary model laid on top of it, where sort of it is fully hollowed out on purpose almost. And then a third is sort of, you point to a sort of congressional revival. And you don't really sort of pick and choose between these. You just sort of see them as three sort of sketches of a future. Well, what future do you think is most likely left alone, right? I don't think it's the revival one. But do you see sort of the pressure mounting towards sort of the rubber stamp Congress, sort of that Congress that is completely hollowed out? Or do you think sort of like the decay model is more?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think this is a fun part of the book. It has these three dispatches from 2039, which will be 250th birthday of Congress. And I found it very easy to write the first two sort of, you know, counterfactual future histories, where the first one of decrepitude is just sort of trying to continue current trends into the future, assume that the policymaking process finds more and more ways to work around Congress, assume that things kind of do get worse than they are on Capitol Hill today. It's really easy to imagine. And I think it ought to be very distressing to people who care about Congress as an institution and who care about the future of American government and American society. Like I think that is the trajectory we're on, and it's bad. I don't know. You read the book for more eloquence than that, but it's really bad. The rubber stamp model, I think, is more meant to counter a certain model of congressional reform that I see as having a lot of energy around it today. And basically the sense is, well, Congress is a big problem. How can we make Congress less of a problem? And the answer is basically get them to shut up. Like basically get them to be a reliable conveyor belt for presidential agendas. And I think some people who are good faith reformers nevertheless sort of don't appreciate just what we'd be losing from that process if we change the institution to make it more pliant, more reliable for the president. And so, yeah, that scenario is really meant to lay out a kind of dystopian vision of, well, let's say those people get their wish. What have we lost in that scenario?
Yeah, I mean, and as you write that, I mean, that just to be clear, sort of the decrepitude model is one where sort of no purposeful action is taken that's coherent. We just sort of keep ambling the way we're going. Where the rubber stamp model implies sort of constitutional amendments that reformers have sort of been able to pressure into the system for the purpose of sort of defanging Congress, or at least making sort of the Wilsonian moment come true. I think your basic model is automatic CRs to end the shutdowns and a reform of the nomination system so the president gets his people unless Congress says no. And then also the introduction of what is common in other presidential systems is the right for the president to set the agenda in Congress, with, I think you posit sort of monthly bills that the president could then get up down votes on, sort of really a move away from our sort of weakish American presidency institutionally towards sort of the picture of the strong presidential systems that have been tried in Central America and other places. Neither of those models, the decrepitude model or sort of the Wilsonian presidency model, are super appealing to me as a policy matter. But I find the sort of purposeful reform model almost impossible to imagine coming to the fore, simply because I can't see the will to get to that either in sort of our ambling decrepitude right now, right? We don't have, you know.
Well, that's heartening that's how you feel. I mean, part of the reason for writing the book is because I sometimes fear that there's this sort of anti-Congress sentiment congealing amongst the educated chattering classes in this country. And that eventually that could amount to sort of a coherent reform movement that has enough energy to push through some of these reforms that do make the place into a rubber stamp. I kind of feel like this, the automatic CRs is the one where it does seem to get a lot of traction sometimes. And a lot of smart people seem to get excited about it. And I mean, government shutdowns are stupid. There's no question about it. But
yeah.
And so Senator Mark Warner has the Stop Stupidity Act, which is his automatic continuing resolution proposal. And that's funny. That's good. That's funny. And I think an awful lot of people are sympathetic to that. And I just have to say, no, sorry. That's a cure worse than the disease.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my hesitation in thinking about the rubber stamp model is that we're at this place right now where I think there's sort of an impulse towards people who want sort of Wilsonian processes to get to their preferred policy outcomes. But we also have sort of like a tremendous fear of the executive bubbling up in both parties when they're out of power. And it's not sort of your garden variety, like George W. Bush is a fascist stuff. This is sort of much more concrete with Trump and now on the right, you know, this perception of sort of Biden as dictator. So I think most people have now resigned themselves to trying to get their man into the presidency rather than sort of empower the presidency right now. I don't see any sort of huge impulse to sort of give the president a genocidal power in Congress. I think that would be sort of met with bipartisan
resistance. That's true. I mean, it more or less requires you imagining one of these 55% scenarios in American politics. And there's really nothing more implausible than that at the moment. The idea that one of the two parties could actually make itself a super solid majority party, that doesn't seem to be on the table at the moment. I do think that part of the exercise of writing these future scenarios made me realize is that, like, probably to get out of the current rut one way or the other requires some kind of shock.
Yeah, your revival vignette shocks as sort of an immigration shock, correct?
Yeah, so I imagine sort of an immigration and refugee crisis, sort of an order of magnitude worse than the one we have now. And I try to make it a little more complicated by saying that a lot of the people trying to get into the country are persecuted Chinese Christians. And maybe Republicans would feel more sympathetic to this group of immigrants than they do to others. And so it would become a cross-cutting issue that would shake politics up, And that shakeup of politics would cause sort of a shakeup of organization in both the House and the Senate, a sense that we have to respond to this crisis in a sort of organic way of actually getting down to it and having the fight in the halls of Congress. That's the key thing about any of these revival scenarios, the one I imagined or any other, would be you actually have to have a sense that having the fight on the merits is the important thing, and doing the partisan politics isn't important enough to suppress that. And like, I've just been expecting that to come for the last decade or so, and it hasn't. Like, the shock.
And I thought it was COVID. Honestly, I think I might have predicted it was COVID. If you told me about COVID 6 months before it right. happened, I might have said, here it is. This right. is your exogenous shock that could, in theory, reinvigorate right. Congress around a shared solution that cuts across parties, that right. isn't partisan. And it just didn't happen.
And we just got this weird month from March to April of 2020 when people were shook up. Politicians were shook up. Sort of nobody knew quite where this was going, other than the fact that we were going to throw a lot of money at it collectively together. And that was what we made happen. And then after that, the sense of shock kind of dissipated. And our professional partisan class is just so good at what they do, right? They got everyone to fall back on their partisan lines, like in quite a big hurry. And by the summer, it was just like we were back to doing the same kind of dances we were familiar with.
Well, it was, you know, it was even more than that, though, because it was also a scenario where Congress looked like it was going to be the leader here in theory, because the president was in many ways sort of out to lunch on this issue. Right. He wasn't even taking it seriously.
Right.
In March of 2020, in a lot of ways, and or denying that it was actually a crisis. And if there was ever a setup for Congress to lead productive policymaking, right. COVID really felt like it.
Well, I think the whole follow the science mantra, like you mentioned earlier, like that mindset pushes against real responsibility taking by legislators, because they're not the experts. They're not. So if it's all about the experts, then we have the experts' defenders and people saying the CDC is doing the right thing, and the experts' detractors saying that these are a bunch of people trying to sell us out to the World Health Organization and blah, blah, blah. But we don't actually come to debate on the merits. You know, politics is the thing that was set up to weigh all these competing priorities, of which there were really quite a lot thrown up into the air by COVID, and to make some reasonable way forward out of them. And, you know, I think in general, like when I look around the world, I don't see a lot of political systems that did well with this challenge. Like in some ways, I wonder to what extent my discussion in this book and my thinking as a scholar is so American centric. But I have to say that I think a lot of these problems are just sort of confronting governments all over the world. And I think their systems are trying to give different answers than ours does. But I feel like just sort of a courageous admission that we're going to have to make hard choices and a willingness to then do it, just not happening right now. So that is very troubling. And I wish I had easier answers for how to get people to feel like that was their jobs.
Yeah. I do wonder, you know, in the comparative context, whether there is something about sort of our contemporary economic world or social world or anything you want to say about it, the way the world is currently set up, that is hostile fundamentally to sort of Republican democratic systems. It does seem like, you know, the rise of sort of interconnected globalized economies and the rise of the internet have led us to a place where there is this increasing attraction towards authoritarian leaders and technocratic competence over sort of diverse representation and sort of the fundamental questioning of liberal democracy as a plausible governing system at the national level. And that does sort of, well, in one way, you can feel good about Congress. It's no worse here than anywhere else, right? On the other hand, you know, the United States is uniquely sort of situated in some ways, maybe with a handful of other countries, England or wherever, to have sort of the benefit of a unbelievably long-term stable liberal republic. At least as a norms issue, and so should be better resistant to these sorts of things. And you should be wondering why we aren't sort of thriving where other democracies may be failing that are newer or less stable or less wealthy.
And at the risk of Godwin's law or whatever, you know, it's not such a source of comfort, because if you read the histories of the 1920s and 30s, like these same feelings of like extreme alienation and a sense that liberal democracy was somehow unequal to the moment, that was sort of the animating global trend back then too. And it didn't lead anywhere good. I do feel, you know, melodramatic in making those kinds of points, but I don't think they're out of place. Like I think that what we're talking about is whether we can make a certain kind of free government work, or whether we just think that we're doomed to be under some kind of form of authoritarianism, whatever it looks like. And I think that's like, yeah, a disturbingly live question today. And we, like those of us who want to live in a world of free politics, like have to fight for it.
Yeah. I mean, I do see, like, I don't, so like, I never, you know, a lot of people posit the dangers that America will become sort of like one of the totalitarian fascist states or whatever, and that, like, that's where the world is heading. To me, the more sort of likely model heading down these roads is, you know, the end result of sort of Wilsonian sort of takeover of this stuff is like 18th century England, right? Where you have not a monarchy, but a extremely powerful executive who is elected, of course. It's still, you know, you still have presidential elections or whatever. But what parliament really is sort of like the last vestige of restraint on that executive. And a weak one at that, and an executive who can relatively easily manipulate the legislature. And, you know, when push comes to shove, the legislature can do things like not give money to the executive, but maybe not even that, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the invocation of like the Latin American parallels is apt. And you're right, you never had sort of runaway fascist dictatorships coming out of that, but you have a sense of, you have some pretty ugly stuff, nevertheless.
Yeah,
a sense that the government is always sort of teetering on the edge of falling apart and sort of things becoming chaotic. And that is sort of the more realistic downside scenario, but it's plenty bad enough.
Well, perhaps we should stop there. Not to end on a terrible note, but thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it, Philip. And love your book, and I hope you do lots more podcasts and end up lots more places, because this is a message that I wish more people would hear, particularly more people in Washington, because I, you know, we didn't touch on it too much, but I do think one of the core audiences for this book is sort of people who have the best interests of the U.S. government at heart in many ways and want to reform it, but have sort of tricked themselves, or at least deluded themselves, in my view, into thinking that the solutions all lie in the executive branch or in technocratic politics.
Amen to all that.
Yes. All right. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time on Congress Two Beers In.
Thanks for having me.